Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking about the toy business. It is a very large industry, and that saying that is something perhaps of an understatement. In fact, every year, the American toy industry puts something like 3.6 billion toys into the home market. Now, that's just the U.S. market. Certainly, the rewards for success in this business can be enormous. A top toy can earn billions of dollars. And as a result, says our guest for this hour, Eric Clark, the toy business has become increasingly ruthless. We'll be talking this morning about his newly published book. It is titled The Real Toy Story, Inside the Ruthless Battle for America's Youngest Consumers. The book has just been published recently by the Free Press. You can certainly find it in the bookstore, I'm sure. Our guest, Eric Clark, is an acclaimed investigative journalist who has worked for the London Observer and The Guardian. He now specializes in marketing and advertising, on which he writes and lectures worldwide. He's done a major study of the advertising industry titled The Want Makers, which has been published in 20 countries. His nine other books also include five novels. He makes his home in London, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk about his book and about the toy industry, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. All we ask of people is they just be brief when they call in, but of course anyone can call in with question or comment. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and you may use that if you're calling, if you're listening in and around Indiana and Illinois, or if you're listening on the Internet in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Clark, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
It's great to be with you.
Well, maybe I'll just ask as a not very imaginative opening question, how it is that you decided that you wanted to do a major piece of reporting on the toy industry?
No, it's a pretty good question, and one that I asked myself a few times while I was working on it. The reason is that, as you mentioned in your kind introduction, I've specialized in marketing and advertising for quite a few years, and I'm also the father of three children. And one of the things that I noticed, or started to notice a few years ago, was that the marketing to children was getting tougher and tougher and more aggressive, that marketers were trying to attract children as consumers in a way that they had never done before. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized that not only going along with this for the toy industry, but in many respects, the toy industry were proving to be the most ruthless marketers. And so I got interested and decided to look at it and spent the last 4 years, in fact, talking to people in the toy industry trying to find out what was really happening.
Yeah. Well, certainly the toy industry is a very big business. Is it possible to say, for example, every year around the world, how much money is spent on toys?
Well, yes, if you look at just toys and don't include video games, you're talking of between $30 and $40 billion a year is spent on toys, which is an enormous sum.
Yeah. And how much of that money is spent by Americans?
Well, one of the incredible things about the American market is that although America only has something like 4% of the world's kids, it spends about 40% of the world's money on toys. And so the amount spent in America this current year is probably going to be about $22 billion.
And of all of these various toys here, you said that something between $30 and $40 billion spent around the world on toys, and that's just on toys. It doesn't account, as you say, some of the other things that are kind of related. How much of that revenue then ends up going into the coffers of American toy makers? How much of the world market do American makers have?
The American makers have something like 40% of the world market. And in fact, two American toy companies alone, the two biggest toy companies, between them have about a third of the whole of the world's sales of toys.
Mm-hmm. And those companies are?
Hasbro and Mattel. Mattel in California and Hasbro on Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm. How has it happened that now that there has been this kind of consolidation? Because certainly over time you can see the smaller companies have been eaten up by the bigger ones. And I'm sure that these days it's very difficult for some kind of a smaller company, let alone someone who has an idea for a toy, to actually develop and sell it. What sort of forces have led to this consolidation so that two companies here have a third of the world toy market?
Well, you're absolutely right in that the changes have been absolutely enormous. Only a few years ago, one of the things that marked out the toy industry was that there were literally thousands of small and medium-sized companies who were inventing and were bringing new products to the market and were competing among themselves. And then what started to happen is in many other industries there was consolidation. And the consolidation was brought about by things that have happened elsewhere, that in fact marketing became supreme. The retailers, particularly Walmart, became all-powerful and liked to deal with big companies. And so what has happened is that, in fact, that the bigger companies have gobbled up the smaller companies, and as if they've done that, they've got bigger, they've been able to use mass marketing techniques and reduce their operating costs. So that rather, as in many other industries, they've just been able to take over. The one big difference, I think, with the toy industry is that to bring a new toy to market and to get it on the shelves in the mass retailers calls for enormous amounts of money and of clout. And so the big companies are the only people who can really do that now.
Mm-hmm. Certainly toys, we know that toys go back a long way in human history. People have been making toys, playing with toys. People have been playing games. So that's not really new. And there have been then commercial enterprises to manufacture and sell them. But it seems that now what we have now today is fundamentally different than what has ever happened before. And as you say, a lot of this has to do with marketing. And I suppose that if you looked at what was the big turning point in the business, it had to be in the 50s, in the mid-50s, when the first toy commercial was run on television. And from that point, that was the watershed moment, I expect.
Yes, that was one of the probably the biggest watershed moment. I say in the book that I think there have been three big watersheds in the recent history of toys. One of them has been television, particularly in the 50s. The other one was the invention of the Barbie doll. And the third one was the start of Toys R Us. Television was particularly important because what it did was two things. First of all, it proved that, in fact, that if you advertise something, you sell it very hard and very extensively, it works. And advertising did and does work with toys as with other products. But the second lesson that television brought home was probably an even bigger one. It enabled the toy makers or the toy companies to go straight to the kids. Up until that moment, children's toys were sold via the parents. The parent was the kind of gatekeeper on this. And suddenly, with television, the toy companies could go straight to the kids. And from this developed a tremendous number of things. It put power really into the hands of the children who wanted the toys rather than the parents who were giving them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, first of all, I think maybe I should introduce again our guest for anyone who might just have tuned in. We're talking with Eric Clark. He's an investigative journalist. He's worked for the London Observer and The Guardian. He's authored a number of books. He's written a lot about marketing and advertising, and he is the author of a recently published book that looks at the toy industry, and it is titled The Real Toy Story, Inside the Ruthless Battle for America's Youngest Consumers. The Free Press is the publisher. It's just been out officially now for, I don't know, about 10 days or a couple of weeks, and I'm sure that if you would like to read on the subject, look for the book. Otherwise, here on the show, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a basic question, and one of the things that you talk about in the book is how it is that a toy goes from someone's idea to actually being something that you can walk into Toys R Us or Walmart or FAO Schwartz or wherever and pull off the shelf. Who comes up with the ideas for toys?
Well, it's a joke these days that there's probably more inventors than there are toys to make. But it is the most of the great toys over the last 100 years have come from individual inventors who had a great idea and have fought to see it come into fruition. So it is from individuals in the main. They have a harder time than ever before. Many of them are amateurs. There are a number of professionals. There are probably about 300, at the most 500 professional toy inventors in the United States. But they have all of them, the amateurs and the professionals, have a very much harder time than they used to, because toy companies these days are not as interested in individual toys. What they want to do is extend their lines of toys. So they want a toy which is related to a toy they've already got on the market. Or alternatively, they want a toy that's linked with a movie or a television program. This is something that makes the, or they think, makes the risk smaller for them and gives them an already preordained market. But the inventors who do break through, and they still do, the rewards, as you said earlier, can be absolutely enormous for them. Ty Warner managed to get himself into the Forbes list of the world's richest men by coming along with the idea of Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
But having said that, for everyone who succeeds, I would imagine that there's several thousand who actually fail.
And I'm sure that also big toy companies, they come up with ideas that they develop and put down there in the market, and they fail too. That doesn't necessarily, just because you're Hasbro or Mattel doesn't mean that you can't also develop something that turns out not to be successful.
No, but that's fairly unusual. Oddly enough, the toy companies are among the few companies in the world who don't come up with a lot of original product themselves. This wouldn't apply to other industries. The toy companies still need to go out and draw in ideas from outside. So a big toy company like Hasbro or Mattel or even smaller toy companies will have someone in the company, one or even a whole department, who will go out and liaise with inventors. The big companies, let me give you an example, say Fisher-Price, with whom I spend quite a lot of time. They will send out two men several times a year who will tour around the United States and other parts of the world just talking to inventors and looking at their latest inventions. And if something strikes them as being a possible new toy, they will take that idea back with them to Fisher-Price in the United States, and then it will go through the various layers of command to see whether it's likely to work or not. But even in this way, they will go out, and perhaps only from professional inventors, they may bring back 6,000 ideas. But of those 6,000 professional ideas, only something like 20 or at the most 40 will ever get through to becoming toys on the shelves.
Mm-hmm. And do the people that then they buy the ideas from, and I'm certain that what they must do is that they must give the inventor something, but and then I would also think that they would require that person to sign away everything, all rights to the idea, so that then the inventor cannot come back later and say, oh, well, you took my idea and you didn't fairly compensate me.
Well, once upon a time when the toy industry was much more gentlemanly and much more relaxed and nowhere near as ruthless and tough as it is these days, the relationship between inventors and toy companies used to be a fairly loose one, that they would sit down on both sides, that they would kick ideas backwards and forwards, and something might emerge from that, and they would come to a loose understanding, and payments would be made. These days, it's like almost any other tough business. It is done through agents, it's done with signed contracts, and with the lawyers always standing in the wings. So what would happen these days is that no big toy company, incidentally, would ever take an idea or even look at an idea from someone who wasn't a professional inventor, who it knew, or through an agent. They just won't deal with small men, partly because of the worry that they will be accused of stealing an idea. But what would happen, this would be done very formally. The invention would go ahead and be turned into a toy after they'd signed legal documents, and there would be a royalty paid on this. The royalty might amount to an enormous amount of money. It might be a very small sum.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that then the do the inventors have some sort of option to say? And in the book, there are stories about people who were were offered some sort of a deal on an idea, where it said, okay, what we'll do is we'll pay you a certain amount of money up front. You can take that money and go. Or we'll pay you a little bit less, but then if this idea is successful, then we'll give you part of the proceeds. And there are stories about people saying, give me the money up front. And later they realize they lost tens of millions of dollars because...
Oh, indeed. There have been a number of these. I think this would be less likely these days with lawyers and agents involved. But the great one is the man who came along with the idea of G.I. Joe, which, of course, has been one of the great toys and still is one of the great toys. And he was offered a deal by Hasbro. He was told that he could either have $100,000, which was a great deal of money at the time, or he could have $50,000, and he could also draw a royalty. And he thought about it very carefully, I imagine, for some time, and he decided that he would go $100,000. And it's been estimated, you can only guesstimate, but it's been estimated that he's lost, because of that, at least $25 million over the years.
I'm sure that'd keep you awake at night.
I think it probably would. The other one is the number of people who've been asked to invest in toys. I mean, quite often people who come along with toy or game inventions, they have a job getting them off the ground, but they really believe in them. And they might, first of all, have them manufactured or do something to put money into them themselves. And a great example of this was Trivial Pursuit, where it took the two inventors of Trivial Pursuit 3 years before they actually got this thing moving. They borrowed money. They came very close to penury, to bankruptcy, before they got it off the ground. But one of the things they did, they asked their friends if they would like to buy a small part of the business. Now, a lot of people said no, but one or two said yes. There was a copy boy at the newspaper at which they'd worked who managed, by borrowing and also cashing in some of his savings, to raise $1,000, which he put into this new game, Trivial Pursuit. And I don't know how much he's made from that, but he's certainly made at least $5 or $10 million from his investment.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that tells us, and your earlier example about the fact that the big toy companies, they go out regularly and they talk with inventors, and then they might buy a number of ideas that maybe they think have some potential for being developed. But then of those, a small percentage actually do end up being developed and then marketed and then successful. How, when at these companies, when they're looking at all of these various ideas, things that they might develop and that might be successful, how does anyone ever really know what's going to work and what will turn out to be a successful product and what would be a flop?
The honest answer is that nobody knows, and this is what makes the toy business both so exciting and also so ruthless. It's exciting because it's the only business where, in fact, you can be a millionaire today and be bankrupt tomorrow if you back the wrong one, or you can have nothing today and be a very rich man tomorrow if you go for the right one. They do everything they can, of course. They use all the research that it's possible to use, and they employ every technique that you can have, and certainly they put in enormous sums of money into the marketing, billions and billions, to help sell them. But at the end of the day, no one really knows. Someone once said that the toy industry is this strange business where you've got a bunch of adults who are trying to guess what in 12 months' time a three-year-old is going to weigh when he's 4 years old. And if you can do that, you've made it. But most of the time they don't, which is why there are far more failures than there are successes in the toy industry. And this is why, of course, they fight so hard to get whatever the small amount is going there.
I'm sure that it must be the case that in whatever business you're talking about, people who are successful, it has to be because they love the thing that they do. And I'm sure that people who are in the computer business love computers, and people who are in other businesses love those things. But there does seem to be a curious sort of person, in a sense, and a curious relationship between person and product when it comes to the toy business.
Yes, I think this is one of the things that has changed to a large degree. Once upon a time, the toy business was what is still referred to, I think, as the old real toy men, and there are still a few of those around. But what has happened these days, I think, is that you have the toy industry on two levels. On the one level, you still have the small companies and the individuals who care about toys, who desperately want to make toys, who really would consider themselves real toy men. But the business overall as a mass market these days is run by corporations. And the people who are running those corporations in the main are almost entirely people who could equally be as well selling soap, or they could be selling insurance. And many of them have been selling other products and have moved into the toy industry, possibly only for a while before they move out into another industry. This is one of the problems with the industry today, I think, that it is so big at the top that it has to be a mass market industry. And because it's a mass market industry, it has to employ the techniques and do the things and sell the kind of products that suit that industry rather than would suit the children.
And that you think that the marketing now is dictating product rather than the other way around?
Oh, yes. I think that the one thing, the moment you realize that the truth about the toy industry is when you realize that, in fact, that the majority of toys are not made for children. They are made for marketing purposes.
Is there something that stands out in your mind as a particularly good example of that?
I think one of the ones at the moment, it's a group of toys, but I think one of the things at the moment are all the toys that are being sold as educational products, which is a growing and a vast market. And these are products which are being sold for children as young as a few months old. Now, these products are there in the main because they satisfy a lot of marketing considerations. First of all, they've become cheaper to produce because they use computer chips, and computer chips and electronic toys generally have become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Therefore, they're well worthwhile to produce. And secondly, because children have been growing out of toys earlier and earlier, they suddenly open a new market for the toy makers, and that's to go for very, very young children with these toys. Thirdly, they can be sold for quite a lot of money compared with other toys because they do appear to satisfy an educational role. And then fourthly, they play upon one of the great things that the toy industry has discovered is good for marketing in the last few years, and that's to play on parent guilt. And in this case, it's playing on the parent guilt that you really need to give your children the very best. You really need to educate them, to give them everything that's available. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth about these toys, I think that most people who know about education and small children would say, is that, in fact, they're probably nowhere near as good as giving a kid a box and playing on the floor with it. But they look nice, and they flash lots of little lights, and they say things. But they are more a marketing phenomenon than anything else.
We are at our midpoint of this hour of focus, and let me again introduce our guest, Eric Clark. He's an investigative journalist, formerly with the London Observer and The Guardian. He now specializes in writing about and lecturing about marketing and advertising, and he said that was that interest, the fact that he was, in fact, interested in those things, led him into looking closely at the toy industry, and that is the subject of his new book. It's The Real Toy Story, Inside the Ruthless Battle for America's Youngest Consumers. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Free Press. He has 9 other books that include 5 novels. He lives in London. He's joining us by telephone from there. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You said that in the book that you make this argument that there were 3 very important events, developments, watershed points, one of them being television. And this was something that we saw especially in the 1950s. Certainly that's the period of my childhood, and I can remember that proved that if you advertise your product, it will sell, and that one of the things that particularly it enabled toy manufacturers to do was to market their product directly to kids. And before, the toys were sold, basically, were sold to parents. The parents bought the toys. Now we see the situation where the pitch is made right to the kids, and then they go to the parents and say, I want this thing. Having said that, though, if you look at what has happened in the way and then the manner in which toys are marketed and advertised, your argument is that even from the beginning of this to now, we have seen some changes in the ways that toys are sold. What would be the fundamental changes that you see?
Oh, I think there have been enormous ones. That business that we talked about of television enabling and showing the toy companies that they could go straight to kids, that was only the start of it. They realized this, but at that time, we're talking about the 50s now, at that time, marketing men in the toy industry and in all other industries, they still regarded children as something rather special. You didn't go for them. You didn't chase them as hard as you would chase adults. And this continued to be true for quite a long time. Children were still regarded as people who were not able to cope with these kind of pressures pushed on them by the marketers and the advertisers. And then a few years ago, partly because times were getting tougher and tougher for the toy industry and for a few other industries that were dealing with kids, the climate among marketers started to change. And so they began slowly at first to take the gloves off, and then they took the gloves off almost completely. And other ways of approaching kids were suddenly being used, the kind of things that wouldn't have been done just a few years before. I mean, one of the things, just to give one example, the internet is a great place, of course, to approach kids directly. On the internet, kids are approached by advertisers and by marketers in such a way that it appears to those kids that they really are dealing with and are conversing with other children. But in fact, what's been happening is that they've been planted with ideas for new toys that they ought to go out and ask for. Hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about it. You said that there were these basically three big moments, and one that we've talked about some, and that is television and marketing. Maybe we talk a little bit about the others, and the second one that you mentioned was Barbie. That was just for people in the business, I suppose, this was just a world-changing toy. And now a lot has been written about Barbie, and I'm sure there have been documentaries made about Barbie, and, you know, there's a big thing here. I guess the thing you have to remember about Barbie is that in as much as she has been extremely successful, that initially a lot of people in the business looked at Barbie and thought that, well, they were horrified by Barbie, first of all, because she was so buxom, but just the very notion of it was completely unlike any other doll, and they were actually kind of disturbed by Barbie.
They were indeed. Barbie is now 47 years old, and he's still, I think, the greatest figure in the modern toy industry. The incredible thing about Barbie is, you say, that she broke new ground when she came along. Her inventor, Ruth Handler, had a great problem, even at her own toy company, Mattel, of persuading them that they should go ahead with a Barbie doll. They thought that it would never work, that it was too sexual, it would be too hard to make, that girls wouldn't like it. The reason why Barbie was such a breakthrough for the toy industry is that Barbie was a toy which showed that, in fact, that the thing to do was to produce a toy which wasn't just a sale in its own right. It was just the start of the selling process. So if you sold somebody a Barbie doll, that wasn't the end of it. It was like saying an adult a razor, where they had to keep on buying blades. And with Barbie, the girl bought the Barbie doll and then suddenly had to start going all the clothes and all the toys, the cars, the swimming pool, all the friends, all the pets, everything that came along with it. That was the great breakthrough for the toy industry as far as Barbie was concerned. It was the start of the toy as just a part of a buying process for a whole number of related toys.
Yeah. And it worked for, once they saw that how well that worked for Barbie, it also worked with other things. That initially, when G.I. Joe was introduced, if people will remember the original ones that were, I think they were a foot tall, they were big. It was the same kind of deal. You got the guy, but then you can send the guy out into the world unarmed. So an arms race began, and so then you had to buy various kinds of stuff to go with it. So it was that same kind of model, and I guess now ever since we've seen that applied in different sorts of ways.
That's right. And it's not only that you've got to keep buying the things, but a successful toy company, of course, will bring along new things every season for this. So even if you were one of those people who was able to go out and buy all the various accessories for your G.I. Joe, at the end of the year, you're going to have to buy another number of them.
Mm-hmm. How much money now has Barbie made?
It's impossible to say over the years, but Barbie is still bringing in something like $3.5 billion a year into the coffers of Mattel. It's not just Barbie the doll anymore, of course. It's Barbie as an icon in her own right. So there's the Barbie clothes, there's the Barbie makeup. There is a whole enormous division inside Mattel that deals only with Barbie. As far as the toy's concerned, for example, she has 10 full-time hairdressers in the company.
It's really astounding that something like this has that kind of longevity. Not only has she been going strong here now for 47 years, but to say that she was going strong is something of an understatement when you consider just how much money has been spent and how recognizable she is, and how little girls, I guess, are still buying Barbies, but then there are also adults who are. Who are still buying Barbies. They may take them and put them on a shelf, but they're still buying her. So the appeal for this product is really very broad and remarkably robust now after more than four decades.
Yes, Barbie has represented, though, in just the last few years, she has been probably one of the main signs of the changes that have been happening in the toy industry as far as their customers are concerned. One of the major things in the toy industry, and one of the things that has made it tougher and tougher for the industry, and because it's been tougher and tougher, has made them much more hard-nosed and cutthroat, has been that kids have been forsaking their toys very much earlier than they used to. When you're looking back to the beginning of the days of Barbie, it wasn't unusual for a girl to continue playing with her Barbie doll, certainly up until the age of 12, perhaps even longer than that. These days, it would be very, very unusual to find any girl above the age of 8 who would confess that she played with a Barbie. It would be regarded as much too childish. So one of the things that has happened is that toys like Barbie are now being played with a younger age group, and the older children, whether they're boys and girls, have been moving away more and more to non-toys, or to toys which might have a different kind of definition to them, things like cell phones and iPods they've been going to and forsaking their toys.
Mm. Has someone now done some kind of a study of what is the average life for a toy? I mean, and by that I don't mean how long does it take between the time it comes out of the box and the time that it's broken, but between the time it comes out of the box and then and may still be functioning, but the child simply loses interest or says, I'm too old for that now, or something like that.
Yes, I mean the first one about how long kids play with toys, which is related to the second and bigger question, is of course that toys are played with less and less. And I think there are statistics, certainly in the United Kingdom, that show that something like 60% of toys are not being played with within a week of them being given to the child. So toys are dumped very quickly by children. This is something that toy companies don't mind very much, even though they might say they do, because, of course, if you dump toys, you need more toys, and so there's a constant turnover. As far as how long a toy stays on the market, as long as it stays on the shelves, it is considered a success if a toy now goes into a second year of life. The majority of them last only for 1 year. A few will go into a second year, a very tiny number into a third year. A doll like Barbie these days would be extremely exceptional.
When you look, and I'm sure that people have looked at this question of why it is that children become, I suppose essentially what it is they're bored, become bored with a particular toy and want to go on to something else. I guess you could explain that in a variety of ways. You could say something about the toy in itself is limited in its ability to satisfy, or it could have something to do with the fact that kids have come to expect expect something new. And so for that reason, there's a lot of turnover because they have it for a little while and then they say, well, now what else have you got for me? Does that have something to do with the toys themselves, that their, you know, their play potential is maybe limited? Or is it that we have raised in children this expectation that they're continually going to have something new, and that we have built into them a kind of short attention span, or at least a very high threshold of stimulation?
I think you've put your finger on what is the central problem of the whole of the toy industry and the whole business of playing these days. I think all of these things have happened. I think the toys themselves, in the main, the majority of new toys that come into the market, and I'm talking about the mass market now, I'm not talking about individual toys that might be made by small companies and sold in specialty shops, but I'm talking about the mass market of toys that's produced in enormous quantities. The majority of them have little or no play value these days. They're either linked with a television show or a movie where the play pattern is already built into it, that you act out something that you've always been told or have seen on the screen. Or they do very much by themselves, that they've got electronic chips, and so they perform, and at the end of their performing, I mean, what are they? They're just nothing. They haven't got play pattern built into them. I think the second thing is that, in fact, that we have, this is not only the toy marketers, I think it's probably all of the companies that market to kids, but they have decided that the way to sell product is to stimulate kids into wanting more and more, more often. And I think it is a truism that if you offer somebody something, if you offer a kid something, they would rather have it than not have it. And so I think it's a combination of the two. The marketing has made the situation worse. At the end of it, when those toys that are bought because they've been marketed so hard and so successfully, the kids get bored with them very, very quickly. They put them on one side. Marketing takes over and sells another product. I'm not, of course, discounting the fact that there is more and more and more for kids to do anyway, not only toys, but there are lots of other things. I mean, there's the computers, there's television, there's a tremendous amount going on. There's a lot of competition for kids' attention these days.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Eric Clark. He's an investigative journalist, formerly with the London Observer and The Guardian, who now specializes in writing and lecturing about marketing and advertising. He is the author of a newly published book. It's published by the Free Press. The title is The Real Toy Story, Inside the Ruthless Battle for America's Youngest Consumers. It's out in the bookstores now if you'd like to read it. We have a couple of questions here, a couple of people with calls, and they can help us by being brief again because we're really headed into our last 10, 12 minutes. We'll start out with Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I wanted to return to what you referred to as taking the gloves off with the advertising, and could you just tell us what the EU does on advertising? And I think Sweden doesn't allow any ads for children in certain periods of time or something, even on the commercial stations that do exist there now. And it wouldn't be surprising if the big toy companies, since they have so much money at hand, are probably going to call that an unfair go to the WTO with that and complain about it. So I don't know if they've done that already, or that's just too embarrassing. Would you just sketch that out a little bit, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, yes, of course. There are restrictions on advertising in some countries. The main one is the one you mentioned in Sweden, where no advertising is allowed to children under the age of 12. And in a number of other countries in Europe, there are restrictions that are placed on them more than there are placed in the United States. The advertising industry and the toy industry, not surprisingly, is against all of this, that they think that it is wrong. And one of the reasons that they think it is wrong is that they think, and they argue sometimes, that in fact that children are in a commercial world, and it's far better that in fact that they're subject to commercial pressures at that age and learn how to cope with it. The truth is that of course, advertising is the thing that sells toys better than anything else, and the toy companies and the advertising agencies would hate it to go. I think one of the things that one needs to do is to draw a kind of division between advertising that is openly advertising and that which is disguised advertising. I mean, I think there can be arguments against both if they're directed at children who are too young. I think advertising in all countries, most countries, is directed at children who are too young, certainly in the United States. But advertising which is disguised advertising, like programs which are built only to sell toys, of which there are a tremendous number, of course, in the United States and now in other countries, that kind of advertising, or advertising which is on the Internet, which purports to be a game for children to play, but in fact has hidden advertising dotted throughout it, that I think is more reprehensible. But the toy companies and the advertisers will fight every inch of the way to preserve every bit of it they can, because marketing really is the thing that drives the industry.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. As a grandparent, it's been interesting to try to figure out how to deal with all this. My grandkids are still pretty young, but having learned some of this from having been a kid myself and having had kids, I'm finding that one should ask the parent how much more stuff they want in the house and what the kid thinks the child really is actually playing with. We've found that at the age our grandkids are, finding a good company that sells to nursery schools and elementary schools for things like really good blocks that you can add to, block sets that are unitary. And it seems to me that Brio and Lego have got it down as to the being able to buy a basic set and then keep on adding to it. I think our grandson has a small fortune in Brio, but I know that he plays with it a lot, and it also sucks in the parents and the grandparents when they're visiting. So some of the higher-end toy companies have found this out, and I think Lego... Although Lego doesn't seem to be the thing it once was, it still has uses the technique of adding on, of having new parts you just have to have. But it simulates imaginative play, and so it's kind of hard to get too mad at them. But our kids used to, when they were little, their allowance went toward getting the latest little bit of Lego with some new part that they didn't have. Thanks. Interesting listening to you.
Well, thank you.
Well, I'd very much agree with that about building blocks. I mean, I think that if I was buying toys for children, building blocks would be high, if not top of my list. I think building blocks and ordinary cardboard blocks are probably the best toys that have ever been invented. I think one of the main things to remember with toys, there are far too many of them. I mean, this is the truth. The world is awash with toys. It's almost going to collapse under it. I remember that when I went into my first toy fair in New York and looked around and saw the toys that were just about to come out in the following year, I thought to myself, you know, do kids need all these toys? And the truth is they don't need all these toys. The toy industry needs all these toys. What children need more than anything else, I think, and I'm saying this as a parent, is that what they want is parents to play with, to interact with them. I mean, if you get down the floor and play building blocks with them, that's absolutely marvelous. One of the things that the toy companies have discovered is that, well, not discovered, but no, is that, in fact, that so many families now consist of working parents or one-parent families who can't spend a lot of time with their children, and they play on this kind of thing, and they sell a guilt thing, and toys are given, are sold to be given by parents who feel in a way that they're getting rid of their guilt by doing this. But the kids don't need the toy. The kids need the parent.
All right. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go on to somebody on a cell phone here, line three. Hello.
Yeah, kind of following up on what you just said, I had 2 points, and then I'm going to hang up and listen. One is, how many toys are essentially marketed to adults? I'm thinking a lot of the kinds of fairly boring ones where you push a button and it does a few things and whatnot, and it's cute for about 45 minutes to an hour or something like that. But in that case, I think the decision to buy it is really often being made by the adult, and it looks cute on the shelf. And as a consequence, the purchase is made. And so one of the things is that the companies, they care about whether something gets purchased, not whether something gets played with. And I think this actually occurs among things that adults purchase, too. So this isn't something unique to children. The other point I'd make is there's a book that I read not too long back by Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice. And I don't know whether David ever interviewed Professor Schwartz or not, but one of the things that he points out in there is that the constant opportunity cost presented by lots and lots and lots of options tends to mean that you churn through your options, which tend to be quickly discarded. You're never really satisfied with any of them because you've got so many and you had to give up something to get the one you got. So in a sense, what you ended up getting looks bad in comparison with the huge blizzard of options that are out there. So I guess I'll leave you with that and let you react to that. Thanks.
Okay.
I go along with both those points, I think. I think a lot of toys are actually bought by adults who see them and think that they're very exciting because they perform on the shelves a little bit. I remember one of the long sessions I spent with inventors was the inventor who invented the first Tickle Me Elmo. And he was saying that he went along to a toy shop and saw a number of parents when this was on sale, when he first went on sale, and he saw a number of parents with children. And he said it was the parents who were laughing, it was the parents who were having fun, even though they were buying it for the kids. And I think quite a lot of that happens, and then they get the toy home, and the kid is not the slightest bit interested, having spent half an hour watching it perform, because there's nothing to play with. As far as so much choice, well, this has just got to be true, of course. I mean, the more choice that there is, the more difficult it is to know what to stay with, and you just move on to another one.
Well, we'll go again to another call here. This is Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Yes, I was going to say that having studied early childhood development, that the most successful toys for children are the ones that are most open-ended and can be used creatively. There's actually a set of building block toys that are called Duplo that work for toddlers compared to Lego, which has a real need for fine motor. The Duplo are much bigger and easier for younger kids and toddlers to play with. And one thing that always works very well is a pad of paper and a box of crayons. Children will use those kinds of things over and over again. They develop a certain artistic sense, and certain development occurs through those kinds of playthings. And I think that if there was a little bit more education on the part of parents about what a quality toy for a child is at a certain age or stage, that this would cause some better choice making.
Well, I expect that Mr. Clark, you would agree with that.
I would agree with that, yes. I think that one of the things you have to remember in all of this is that quite often, or most of the time, that what parents and what the toy companies, the big toy companies, want are different. the parents really want and should want toys which their children are going to play with, whether it's cranes or whether it's building blocks or whatever. What the toy companies want is a toy that they can produce in literally millions and millions of the same unit, and which after a certain time will have to replace with another toy which can also be placed in millions and millions.
We're to the point where, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to finish. There are a lot of things that perhaps we could have touched on, particularly an issue that you deal with the book, and that is where toys are made. And the people who are making them are not the people who are buying them in large part. And unfortunately, we really won't be able to do that. I guess that to finish up, it doesn't seem likely that things here in the toy business are going to change. And in fact, what seems to be the case is that these kinds of trends that we've talked about, we should only expect them to intensify, I would think.
Yes, that's certainly the kind of gloomy side. And when I'm thinking about this in a gloomy mood, this is the way I feel about it. And then I feel occasionally optimistic, and there are people who really do care about this. And I think a lot of parents have started to worry. And you look around at a number of things, and you see that consumers can change things, that there are things that have happened which people used to think would have been impossible. I mean, you know, things like good food labeling, which at some stage you would not have even contemplated is now there. I think there can be changes, but it would be very, very difficult because there is a huge machine there.
Well, there, I think that we will have to stop. If you want to read the book that we've mentioned, it's The Real Toy Story, Inside the Ruthless Battle for America's Youngest Consumers. It is published by Free Press. It has just come out by our guest, Eric Clark. He's an investigative journalist. He's written for the London Observer and The Guardian. He has 9 other books, including 5 novels, and he's particularly interested in and has written a lot about marketing and advertising. And Mr. Clark, thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you.